I love books. I inherited that from my mom, this love of stories. But have you noticed how many lousy stories and how many lousy books are out there? Go to the library and bring home an armload of books that you're going to read, you know, late at night when you get home and those sort of things, and you'll pick up and you start reading and you go, oh, bless their heart, they're just not a story here. And you set that book aside, and you start another one, and you just lose interest in it later because there just wasn't a story there. But when you find a good story, when you find an author who knows how to write a great story, oh, man, that is death to sleep, isn't it? I mean, you are up at 4 in the morning still turning pages like crazy. This story grips me. The story's like with that hobbit where everybody else who lives in the village in the land of the hobbits, they're just really interested in the next meal, and there's lots of meals every day, and they're pretty interested in their comfort, and they're pretty interested just in their own lives, and that's their whole universe. But this hobbit has, and you start reading that story and the twists and the turns, and your heart races, and you cry over a book, and you laugh. Great stories. Tolkien made the comment, he said, I only hope to imitate the stories God is writing. That's really true. That's really true. You can tell when God has written or is writing a story. There are a lot of bad stories, a lot of shallow stories, a lot of non-stories, but when God writes a story, my goodness, the twists and the turns, the apparent disaster in the middle of it, the resurrections, both physically and metaphorically, the perseverance, the triumph. When God writes a story, you don't have to guess who the author was. You just start through the scripture. We take them for granted. We've learned them as children, many of us. You take this couple, and they go on a journey to the unknown, and they don't know where they're going, and they go along with this cast of characters around them that are really kind of shady characters, really, when the dust all settles, and Abraham takes off, and you have this promise of a great nation, but they have no children, and year after year, they have no children. They're an old couple. They're nursing home kind of people, and God's still saying, you're going to love the baby you get one of these days. And you get the twists and the turns, and the baby is born. And when the baby is born, then you find, lo and behold, there's this other twist, a twist God himself had to know that they were going to put. And you go, wow, you don't want to do that, Abraham. No. And then it twists again, and then you find the mountain, and just it goes on and on and on with this great story. When God writes a story, be a boy named Joseph, and Joseph is going to be in a family, and that family's a three-ring circus, and they don't get along, and you think Thanksgivings at your house are tough. And you think your boys wrestling in the backyard have some problems on occasions. And this kid ends up, and he's sold into slavery, and the triumph, and the disaster, and the false charges, and the prison, and the broken promises, and the... Man... If you never knew who wrote that story, you could figure it out in the middle of it. God's writing this story. You take Moses, this incredible story of Moses and where he starts, and here's this baby in a basket, and then lo and behold, here's this guy who's a murderer off in the desert, and he's old man, and now he's pulled back, and now he stands in front of Pharaoh, and let my people go, and the plagues, and the dividing of the Red Sea, and you're going, God, you're writing a story, aren't you? Yeah, I'm writing. David, I don't care which one you go to, Elijah, Elisha, John the Baptist, Jesus, Peter, Paul, it doesn't matter. When God writes a story, it's a grand story. Which leads us to Paul, and then to you. Paul is writing in 2 Corinthians. We are going through this book, and Paul opens up the story of his own life, and he opens up what God is writing in his life. We're in 2 Corinthians, the 11th chapter. The question has come up, Paul, you don't look like you're God's man. And Paul begins to explain, and he begins to say, look, you need to understand there's an accusation It's coming from some false leaders. God isn't writing their story, but he's writing mine. And Paul begins to give his defense, and we're in the middle of that defense, and we're not going to cover the whole thing, and I'm just going to take one little bit, and I'm going to ride one horse. I'm going to ride that one horse a long time this morning. Wait, hang on. Okay, what I meant by that is I'm going to stay with one single point is what I really meant. You heard something different than I meant. Here's the text. Paul tells me at least part of his story, and you can tell it's a God story. We're going to start in the 23rd chapter. I think I'm probably going to read off the screen. The version I brought this morning is not the version they had where they could put on the PowerPoint. Let me just read off the screen with you. Are they servants of Christ? I'm out of my mind to talk like this. I am more. I have worked much harder. I've been in prison more frequently. Scholars say that you can at least identify seven times that Paul would have had prison at some level. Been in prison more frequently. Been flogged more severely. Been exposed to death again and again. Don't run by that. Been flogged more severely. You know what that flogging looks like, don't you? I mean, you know what they did. And in fact, they stretched you out. They took off the top so that there was only bare skin. And the guy who beat stood on a rock behind you because he wanted to be up. Because the basic deal was that about a third of the lashes could come on the chest and about two-thirds had to be on the back. And the way they did it was they stand so that when he could hit across the back. And then about every third one, take it over your shoulder so that you could lash into here. And he just puts it in. It's been flogged a lot. Been flogged a lot. Five times I received from the Jews 40 lashes minus one. The Jews had you could 40 lashes is all God would allow. All they believed, and so they did 39 in case we miscount. Five times I received from the Jews 39 lashes. Three times I was beaten with rods. The Romans took sapling sticks. Take 8, 10, 12, 15 sapling sticks. They're very, very flexible. And they put them together like we might put rubber bands around them. And then they would take them and they would beat you with it. So you had a rod, but it spread out and it was flexible. And each stick above the next stick drove it. It had a rubber band type. Three times I was beaten with rods. Once I was stoned. You know about that one. That's where it's not they just push you down in a pit and they stand above you and they just throw rocks on you. I really, personal opinion, I don't think Paul died and was resurrected at that moment. We're told that in the book of Acts, by the way, that he was stoned at that location. I think the book of Acts or the scriptures are very, very clear. Whenever somebody's resurrected, it's very clear. It's never ambiguous on resurrections. This person was dead. They are raised from the grave. On this one, it doesn't say he was resurrected. They said he was left for dead. I think they thought he was dead. But Paul, God wasn't done with him, and he's a tough old bird. And when they left, he got up. Three times I was shipwrecked. I spent a night and a day in the open sea. I've been constantly on the move. I've been in danger from rivers, in danger from bandits, in danger from my own countrymen, in danger from Gentiles, in dangers in the city, in dangers in the country, in dangers at sea, and in dangers from false brothers. I have labored and toiled, and I've often gone without sleep. I've known hunger and thirst. I've often gone without food. I've been cold, and every one of those is a story. Well, Paul, tell me that one. Oh, my. See, that was probably, I guess I'm referring on that one to February of that year. And I was, and we just left the church, and we just got started, and this happened, and then we got drug out, and then this took place. Every one of them is a story. Don't run through those. Every one of them is Paul sitting here going, you know, actually, I think, see that one right there? I think that one came from that episode. Besides everything else, I face daily the pressure of my concern for the churches. I wake up in the middle of the night thinking of you. I get up in the morning and I go, what do I do for these children that I love dearly, this church? Who is weak and I don't feel weak for you? Who is led into sin and I don't inwardly burn?
If I must boast, if I must tell you the story God's writing in my life, if I must, if you push me into this, I will boast of the things that show my weakness. The God and Father of the Lord Jesus Christ, who is to be praised forever, he knows I'm not lying when I tell you these stories. In Damascus, the governor under King Aretas had the city of Damascus guarded in order to arrest me. Why do they put such big words in the Bible? But I was lowered in a basket from a window in the wall, and I slipped through his hands. And let me tell you, there was a time, and we were in this house, and the house had a window on the outside wall, and they came in the basket, and there was only three little old skinny gals, and you know, they let me down. I mean, stories. Tell me your story. We all live in a story. We either live in a story that I'm at the center, and it's a story of ease and comfort and achievement, accomplishment, preferences, likes, meals I went and ate, my story. Or we live in a story that's bigger than us, a story written by somebody else, because we would never write that big of a story. We would never write ourselves in with these kinds of episodes in this kind of a story. We wouldn't get out of the bed and say, this is the kind of thing I want to have happen to me. But when I'm a part of a bigger story, a story that an author is writing, that I say, write me into your story, then this creator, creating author, begins to write stories big enough about things worth sacrificing for, things worth having a passion about, things worth suffering, things worth having risks and scars and hardships and perseverance and endurance and triumph and cause. Paul unpacks his story in this little text, a portion of it at least, and it has the marks of a God story. Every God story has a couple three things. I want to mention them this morning. The first one, every time God writes a story, it has risk. It has risk. God never writes a story without risk. Dare you. Start from Genesis, read through Revelation, find a story God wrote any chapter, any place without risk. I know I need a metaphor for something for you to see, some way to tell this. Kids, at least of a certain age, perhaps multiple generations, recognize the universal dodgeball or prison ball kind of thing. We all had it. My school had its own versions. Every coach has his own nuances of it. And so it's a funny thing when you're in the game of prison ball, dodgeball, whatever hybrid of it they did. You can think that your job in this is there's two teams and there's a center line and there's probably a place that you go if you've been hit with a ball and you're out of the game until somebody from your team might release you and get you back in by a series of things and how they do it. But there's a belief that many people have in prison ball that the object of the ball, or the object of the game, is me never to get hit. And so when they're got the game, I'm back here. I'm on that back line, and I'm nimble, and I was nimble enough, and I'm going to move, and you can throw all you want, and all the rest of you can throw, but the object of the game is I'm not going to get hit. I'm not going to get hit. When the game's over, I'm going to be the one who everybody sort of says, wow, he's pretty spectacular. He never got hit. He hid behind the girls. He hid everywhere else under the sun, but he never got hit. Look at him, boy. He dodged down here and there. I mean, and when the game was over, he has no bruises. He has no red marks. He might even got a few other people, but he himself never got hit. Boy, that's the object of the game. Quite frankly, I remember as a fourth grader, fifth grader thinking that. But I think you grow up, you mature a little bit, even in silly little kids' games. You realize when you went to the lunchroom afterwards, there was no, hey, that's the kid that didn't get hit. That's a kid that doesn't have any bruises. That's a kid that had any red spots. That's a kid that I shot, I aimed at 70 times and never hit him. You come over here at our table. We want you to sit with us. That didn't happen. In fact, you had to walk into the lunchroom and say, hey, I never got hit. Oh, yeah, right. Nice job. And nobody cared. Because there was a second game that occurred within the plot. Because there were individuals who decided, no, the story is not, can I avoid all contact? I'm taking risk because there are people I can set free. And I'm going to get out and I will block balls and I will release people and I'll be on the front lines and I'll be taking out some of their people and I will be in the middle of the game. And when you went to the lunchroom afterwards, the guy who never got hit stood on the back row, went to the lunchroom and had no story. But everybody was saying, just in conversation, hey, come sit with me. Hey, that was hilarious. I hit you in the middle of the chest, blew you out of that game, and you got back up and got back in. In fact, I thought you were dead. Nice job. You know that time that you got me on the side of the head, and wow, what a big red mark you've got there. But it was stories of risk and release and capture. It was a story of life. And one kid's going, hey, I didn't get hit. Boy, see, I got through life unscathed. And another kid is going, I have an entirely different story. And the lunch tables were about those who interacted and what life was. This is the story of interaction. If I can borrow that metaphor, the Christian life was never, ever designed by God to avoid problems, to live comfortable and ease, to hang on to my faith, to stay at the back line, to be a part of a church, to live safe. Look, there are no scars, there are no red marks, there are no bruises. You see, watching movies and building a 401k, knowing SportsCenter by heart, cupcake wars and a hobby-centered life, an employee-centered life, that's not a story. It's not a story. It's a tragedy. But it's not a story. I think I can even say so clearly, and I think I can say it accurately, God hates an individual who won't take risk. I believe I can say that. I can say that from a lot of places, just going through Scripture. If you're not living a life that has a story with risk in the middle of it, eternal kingdom risk, grand, I'm writing a huge Hobbit story that I'm writing you in. A story over your head. A story that involves shipwrecks and beatings. It'll involve prison. If you're not living that story, I think God hates that. For one, I just take the parable of the talents. You realize the parable of the talents, don't you? That a master called one in and gave me five and gave another one two and gave another one. And he came back later and said, okay, show me. At first, you might say, well, the five who got five is really rewarded. It has to do with accomplishment. And the two who got two is really rewarded. It must be accomplishment. Until you find the one who said, I was afraid to take risk. I was afraid to lose what you gave me. I was afraid something bad might happen to it, so I buried it in the ground. And the one who wouldn't take risk, that's the one. You realize, don't you, this has never been about a parable, about a story back then. This was a conversation between God and Tom. God and Troy, and God and Randy. A riskless life, no matter how much doctrine you hold to be true, is an unfaithful life. And so you see individuals who say, I refuse to live a life, and I'm going to borrow from, by the way, from Donald Miller. His book, I'm going to highly recommend. I'll say some enough things from his book today that you really need to go get his book. A Million Miles in 1,000 Years. Donald Miller. A Million Miles in 1,000 Years. But many of you, quite frankly, you don't want to live a life that when you die, people just shrug their shoulders. Nice guy. I don't think he ever got hit, honestly. Oh, I mean, life hits you no matter what you do, some, but just shrug your shoulders. You want to live a life that when you start telling stories of what God has written, there are stories that are huge. You want to tell stories, and some of you, you have a job that ought to let you go to a closed country, or that lets you go to an unevangelized, under-evangelized country. Some of you need to leave College Heights. Your story's too boring here. You were so gifted. The Spirit of God is in you. He's been trying to write a story. You need to quit the job here. Stay with your company, but you need to go. Some of you ought to be in Europe. Some of you, I'd love to get postcards from Africa, India. Some of you need to go. Some of you are retired. There's nothing holding you here. You need to go. Your story is too safe here. You're writing a non-story. Or some of you, you need to stay here, but you need to just simply change how you gotta take the job that pays half of what you make now, downsize to the house, because it's time for you to write a better story. Watering your plants all summer, fighting hard to try to keep something green, that's the centerpiece of your life, thinking, where are we going to eat at the next restaurant? That's not a story of a life. Tell me the stories of the shipwrecks. Tell me the stories of the beatings. Tell me the story of the day in a basket. Some of you need to downsize so you can live cheaper and write a better story, and you can begin to fight for the kids whose parents don't fight for them. Some of you need to be in habits where you lose your Fridays and your Saturdays once or twice a month because there's a handful of boys, middle school boys, high school boys, but they're just under-invested in boys. And two or three of you guys take them camping every Friday night. I mean, a couple of months, a couple times a month. And maybe you take the same set of kids and you begin to develop and you begin to go to Devil's Den, which sounds really unspiritual, doesn't it? Maybe it's the thing you ought to be doing. Why are your Fridays and Saturdays? Why is there no story? Why is there no story? Others of you, you're writing incredible stories. You're writing incredible stories, stories that the New York Times would never cover. But when it comes to the time of your demise and the end of your life, people say, this guy died too soon. He was writing a story. And if you're not writing a story, you never really die too soon. You just kind of die. Donald Miller said that. What's your story? Some of you, the reality is you live way too good for single moms in this community and in your neighborhood and in this church to live the way you live, and they live this way. What? Something's wrong with this story. And it can't be drive-by, threw a parcel out the window. It's you came into our life. Risk. For Julie and I, the best times in our ministry have always been the hard things that had risk to them. It's the people who lived with us. Sometimes I thought they'd never move out. It's the vehicle. I didn't know where it was for. I'd loaned it to him for well over a month. We were using the one vehicle. And I lost him for several days. And I didn't have any idea where he was. And he hadn't started very good when we started this story. And I didn't know where it was. Risk. The best times in Julie's ministry and mine in Walker, where I was for 5 years, 35 years ago. My best memories of the last 29 or 30 years here, they never have really to do with just walks on sunny days where I played the back line so nothing hit me. The best stories are stories that had risk. For some of you, quite frankly, you're empty nesters. You ought to make the center of your life the young families. Do you know you could change the life of those babies in that nursery back there? You could change their future. You could change the generational things that occur to them if you stop living a lesser story. Could you think you and God could write a better story? There's always risk. When God writes a story, there'll be a risk. And His Spirit was put in you, and it was put in you to begin to write something. No, you would never write in, I want shipwrecks and beatings. But when you start writing the big story of God, these are the things that are in it. For some of you, quite frankly, the foster care system in Jasper and Newton, and yes, I keep saying it, I still believe God has laid it upon my heart that College Heights and some other great congregations like Orinoco and some others, the foster care system in Jasper and Newton County can be adequately serviced by people who care. And I really do believe our stories will change somebody else's story when God's writing the story. For some of you, it's the story of just fighting for a marriage that you don't know if it'll work. And that marriage is limping, and the easiest thing would be to go to the back line and avoid all the dodgeballs and but to go fight for something, and you're going to get scars and bruising, and but to fight for that marriage, and you don't know how it's going to turn out, there's risk. There's risk. The world always puts a counterfeit. The world always puts a counterfeit. The world always prostitutes whatever is good. That's why a real life is God intended. It is a Joseph and an Abraham and a David and an Elijah and an Elisha and a John the Baptist and Peter's and Paul's and so forth. It always has risk. But when somebody lives a riskless life, the world will come in and give a substitute. Oh, it's a placebo. It's false. It's not a real. But why are casinos? Why do they do bull riding? Now, let me go any number of things you could go with. I remember as a kid, I'm not advertising this. It's stupid. Had I had any idea how much parents cry over the death of their kids? If I had any idea what a car cartwheeling would look like, but why would I have driven the? I tacked it out as far. I know that day. I can tell you where I was. I remember it like it was yesterday. I know what it's like for that hood not to stay on the front. The wheels are about to come off the ground. I'm beyond any mile per hour I would have ever dreamed. Why would I do that? Because there's something in us that requires risk. And if you don't have legitimate things to make your risk, you'll make illegitimate things. Reason many of your kids and your grandkids actually are fighting against the parents and fighting against everything you've raised them on is not because they automatically reject it. It's because there's no story. There's no risk in that, and the pull of the risk, and so they begin to hide from you, and they begin to do all because the pull of the risk is more powerful. We were designed by God for bigger stories. And if your family doesn't write a story that's big enough, they'll write a broken story that has risk. Oftentimes, the reconciliation of a family is nothing more than a family defining. We're going to take kingdom risks that matter. And suddenly, things begin to change for kids and the poor. And this kid who was out here doing all kinds of crazy stuff that was self-inflicted realizes how stupid those risks are. I'd rather take them here. I love being a part of a congregation like this. It has a mixture of the young and the old, because the young still remember the pull of what it's like to go slay dragons. And the old man has slayed a few dragons somewhere along the line, and he's good for the young man and a congregation that's slaying dragons with the old and the young, and we're still taking risks, and we still have stories of shipwrecks and beatings. It's something worth living for. What's your story? Could you and God write a better story? I don't want to be that guy. Phillips 66 put a commercial on. I don't want to be that guy.
I never even got the chance to tell him. He won Phillips 66 gas for life.
I have a reason to live.
Play it again. I want you to hear. Turn the volume up on it louder. I want you to hear this. I want you to see.
I never even got the chance to tell him. He won Phillips 66 gas for life.
I have a reason to live.
And as clever as it may be, I'm offended. There's a wife and a daughter, and the reason to live is I got gas for life from Phillips 66. But don't you recognize you could fill a gazillion things in? For even people in this room, you've lost your zest for life. And you lost it because your story's too small. If you're not living a real story, then you end up living a lesser story, and lesser stories aren't worth really living when the dust all settles. Don't you think the world has had enough of emasculated men and domesticated women? Don't you think it has all the emasculated men and domesticated women it needs? I'm a child of the 60s. I grew up with potheads. I'm a child of the 60s. The Black Sabbath and Black Oak, Arkansas. I mean, all those kinds of bands that I just blew the name on. But I know what a pothead looks like. Somehow we forgot that comfort became the pothead. And ease became the pothead. And people who lose interest in life because their hobbies became their center. There's no difference between the stoned out marijuana guy and I just began to live the American dream. You'll always have risk when God writes a story. When God writes a story, you'll also always have scars. You'll always have scars. You can't take real risk without getting scars. Oh, you can do the pretend play act risk with no scars. The roller coaster is a pretend one. It's supposed to scare the bejeebers out of you, and it does. And I mean, you go, wow, this is a real risk. And you get off at the same spot you got on, and a 12-year-old gets in your seat, and they can do it again. The spook house is supposed to be a real risk. The horror movies are a real risk. Truth is, we know they're not real risk. In fact, if we ever got one scar out of the roller coaster, the horror movie, or the spook house, there's enough lawyers lined up from here to there to make sure, because you're supposed to have a risk with no scars. But kingdom risks are real. You meet real dragons. You fight real spiritual battles. Prisoners you're trying to release will really hurt you. There's real hurts, real blood, real wounds, real tears. And what Paul's telling you is, I have a real story from God because it has real scars. You see, a church like this will have a good friend like KS, who we lost. The night they came and took him away, those officers. And whether they shot him that night or they just put him in a prison and will tell no one where he is. I want to be in a church like this, where none of our stories come without pain. I can't think of his wife and his kids, but his carrying the gospel and our partnership with him and our friendship, this humble, gentle man. I can't say it's like a movie, and so I promise you they'll never... The child that you adopt sometimes can't and won't accept your love. The family you poured your life into can and will turn on you. The marriage that was weak and that you fought for it with courage and honor, sometimes your partner still walks away. The prisoner that you loved and you brought into your family, the former prisoner, he stole money from you. The home group you shepherded and you fell. Like, these are the people I want to escort safely through hard places in their life. It falls apart because the group becomes divisive. The neighbor kids that you did backyard clubs with and you loved them and they were latchkey kids and you poured your life in them and one of them made a false accusation against you. The ministry you worked so hard on never got off the ground. And when you're in the middle of this thing at 4:00 in the morning, it feels like it's a failure. I should have never taken risk. I should have just stayed on the back line in the dodgeball game. I don't want to discount any one of those. Some of you are in the middle of those now. But I want to remind you that Paul hadn't finished with his story. In fact, we'll pick it up next week. I'm just kind of setting up two parts to this. I want to remind you two things. The scars are real, sure. But here's two things. Many of you thought homeliness just ran in my family. I've actually had about 80 stitches on my face from about 7 different occasions. I got 18 on one spot. I got 7 or 8 on another one. I got 5 here. And about 80 stitches altogether. It's kind of funny about those scars. I loved high school. Really did. All 6 years of it. No, I really liked high school. It was a blast. But you know, it's kind of funny. I don't remember a lot about high school. I mean, the days run together. There's not a lot of memories. I got a few snapshots, but it just all kind of muddies up, except where I got a scar. I can tell you about that one. I can tell you about the football team. I can tell you about the helmet. I can tell you the play. I can tell you the moment. I can tell you who was around. That scar did something pretty powerful. I can tell you what the coach said at the end of the year conversation. There's something in that scar that actually took a funny little twist. What was a scar actually turned out to be some things that, well, most of these have to do with activities I was doing with friends. I hate to be doing it with my enemies. And the bonds of friendship and the moments and the episodes and the places and the stories afterwards, that's really where life is. I remember the things best with the fondest memory that I have a bit of a scar attached to. Because somehow in the scars, the deeper, better things of life happened around it. You want to know the leaders in this congregation that are the closest? The bonds, and Jay and I can start talking about certain situations we've been through, and both of us just begin, our lips begin to bounce, and we just hug each other because there's a past we have where Jay and I were involved, and there's scars we both carry from individuals. Let Rick Bushnell or Kevin Klein or let some of the elders talk. Let us talk. It's the scars that at the moment that hurt so deeply became later on the very thing that only God could write a story that had the scar become that kind of a bonding thing. Have you no scars? And you have no grand stories. And you have no grand friendships. Scars are a key part of it. It's also true, a second thing about scars is that kingdom scars are where you joined God in a story and you allowed His story to be bigger than you. And your story always finishes with, but God. But God. That's what Paul does. But God. The only way you really know God is to be in a place where the risk and the scars are real. But you have stories. Don't you recognize that people who have been in a bigger story come back deeper and more profound? It's like they've encountered God in ways that those of us who just our next meal and are we doing fine and am I missing all the... Did anybody hit me with a dodgeball? There's no stories. There's no stories of God. Is it possible that you and God could be writing a better story? You know, when you first read this list of Paul about beatings, imprisonments, and sleeplessness, and adrift in the sea, and all of that, at your first reading, you're kind of going, oh, what a pity. Man, that's a bad deal. Bummer. I feel bad for Paul. And there's an empathy you have. But the longer you look at it, the more you read the whole context, the more you wake out of your slumber, and the more you envy it. All of those things were born out of a grander story, and all of those things gave birth to a greater part of the story. Why am I writing such a tame story? I don't want to end up my whole life telling other people's stories. How about you? Ever go to a party and stand around awkwardly because you have no stories to tell? I'm not very good at parties. Dull. I married Julie. She is so much more fun. Here, let me stand beside Julie. I don't mind if I don't have any stories to tell at a party, but what I don't want to do is I don't want heaven to be one long party that I had no stories to tell. I don't want to stand around in heaven with no stories to tell. How about you? I want to tell stories about a healed body, but that scar, I had to do that time we brought that family in and they lived with us. And I want to tell you what happened. Because the God who writes big stories. Oh, I know I can leave you frustrated as I finish here because, well, tell me what story. Oh, I have no doubt the Spirit of God in you is not capable of beginning to write a bigger story if you want it written. But that's the question. Do you want a bigger story? Are you willing to subjugate the safety and security of your own life and say, God, write me in. Let me be the hobbit. And if you want to put a ring around my neck on a chain and it has to do with foster kids or it has to do with single moms or it has to do with young unraised kids or these girls or these young marriages or these old people, or it has to do with people who've never heard the gospel, or has to, God, if you want to put a chain around my neck that I carry on behalf of hobbits who have no idea what's happening, put it around my neck, God, here I am. Put it around my neck, here I am. This is not a single sermon. Over the next set of weeks, we're going to keep talking a little bit about what's the story if you and God were to write a better story.